This text that you have before you is taken from the Oxford Dictionary of the Christian Church, and it is an excellent summary of the iconoclastic controversy. This very strange controversy, which racked the Eastern Church for 120 years, from 725 until 842, occurred in two waves, two principal periods of iconoclasm, in the middle of which occurred the Second Council of Nicaea. The council ostensibly settled the question after the first wave of iconoclasm, but there was a revival of iconoclastic frenzy, which had to be put down and eventually repudiated. And at the conclusion of that, there was celebrated what is still regarded as and commemorated as the Feast of Orthodoxy, the Feast of the Validation of and the Reclamation of the Icons. There were a variety of political reasons for this controversy, which we will speak about in a few moments, but one of the great tragedies of it is its success. That is to say, there is an entire generation, almost an entire world of Christian art that was fairly effectively lost because of the image-smashing frenzy on the part of the emperor and especially of the armies who particularly supported, the military especially supported, the iconoclastic approach. In general, it was the monastic movement, the monks, who were very often the subject of persecution because they kept icons, painted icons, and emphasized the importance and value of these sacred images in worship. So there was a kind of a division between the military and the imperial authority on the one hand, and the monastic tradition on the other, with various patriarchs and church leaders standing on either side, and often on the side of the iconoclasts. This controversy would also have influence on and an unfortunate consequence in regard to the West. The West never properly understood or in any sense agreed with the iconoclastic movement. The West never had any problem with the depiction of images, generally speaking. And the Pope, the authority of the See of Rome, was occasionally drawn into the controversy, particularly when the Second Council of Nicaea, the Seventh Ecumenical Council, was summoned, and then later in the resolution of the controversy. But in the midst of all of this, during this very period of strange upheaval, there occurred also an event which caused the East to recoil in horror, and that was the bestowing of the title of emperor on Charlemagne by the Pope on Christmas of the year 800. That had a decisive separating effect as far as the Eastern world was concerned, because there could be in the Christian Empire only one emperor, and the emperor's seat was in Constantinople. The West had suffered under the, as it were, brain drain, the shifting of authority from Rome to Constantinople for many centuries, and one can understand the rejoicing in the Western world at the crowning of Charlemagne, but at the same time, we can't underestimate the powerful negative significance of this for the Christian East, which could not understand how the Pope could imagine that he had the authority to invest a second emperor when in fact there could only be one. So that decisive event occurs in the midst of the controversy and in fact becomes embroiled within it, because when I say that the West never understood it, that's almost literally true. There unfortunately was a very bad translation of the canons of the Second Council of Nicaea, and as a consequence, there was a misunderstanding that caused the West, at least many of the bishops of Gaul, to imagine that the council had decreed that icons could be venerated with the same worship and devotion that was offered to the Blessed Trinity, which is the exact opposite of what the council actually decided. But as a consequence, there was a very anti-Eastern, the Second Council of Nicaea movement, which was only later settled and resulted in even more misunderstandings and controversy. So this controversy controversy, particularly devastating although it was for the spiritual heritage of the Christian East in terms of the destruction of images, also had political and theological consequences and was involved in the factors that caused an ongoing and deepening separation between Eastern and Western Christianity. Turning back again to iconoclasm itself, as we shall see, it's one of the great ironies of history that although it may be that the controversy was partially sparked by the successes of Islam, the Muslim leaders who were able to so effectively claim the right to and completely subdue the territories which represented the ancient traditional sees, the patriarchal sees of the Eastern Christian Church. The sees particularly of Alexandria and of Antioch and Jerusalem very rapidly fell beneath the Muslim soldiers. And the emperor in Constantinople was terribly dismayed at the success, at the crumbling of his own empire. And it has been suggested, and this is controversial, it is really not known why the Emperor Leo III, the Isaurian, became in around the year 726 opposed to the iconic depiction of Christ and the saints. But it's very clear that he did, and that he did it out of religious and personal motives. But it's been suggested that one of the reasons may have been precisely the success of Islam. That is to say, this radically monotheistic, this incredibly anti-image, anti-iconic religious force may have suggested to Leo that God was blessing them precisely because the Islamic movement represented an unwillingness to depict the divine. And indeed, there were abuses of icons. Although there was a very beautiful developing spirituality of the iconic tradition, there were some extraordinary and in some cases very clearly superstitious and inappropriate uses of icons. For example, at baptism, one could have as a sponsor an icon rather than an individual, and that would mean that the individual depicted on the icon was the protector of the child. Well, clearly that's both inappropriate, it is not an understanding of what the role of the sponsor is, and it's a very powerful misuse, a misunderstanding of what an icon can stand for and what it can be. We've already looked in the tradition of the legend of Abgar at the almost talisman-like use of sacred images as a way of repulsing political forces. The sacred image of Christ was regarded as responsible for keeping the Persians out of Edessa. Well, obviously, it didn't work as far as the growth of Islam was concerned. So there may have been a whole variety of reasons why icons became a kind of almost a whipping boy, a kind of a source of blame for the crumbling of the Eastern Empire. But for whatever reason, and there may also have been philosophical and theological and personal reasons, in 726 the Emperor Leo III published the edict which declared that images were idolatrous and were to be destroyed. And this eventually resulted in wholesale persecution of those who produced or kept sacred images. Now, one of the great ironies that I began to mention is the fact that the primary examples of Christian iconography from the period of the iconoclastic controversy and before, that is to say, the only images to survive this image-smashing frenzy, were those which were produced and kept in territories which were subject to Muslim control, because the local Muslim caliphs were very tolerant of Christianity and of Judaism, and as long as no proselytism took place, were very content to have their subjects pay taxes and support their local establishments. But of course, the Christians in these areas were not subject to the jurisdiction of the emperor. That is to say, the emperor's image-smashing soldiers could not reach them in Muslim lands. And so it's in places like St. Catherine's Monastery in Sinai and the area of Palestine where where very important spiritual traditions and theologians such as John Damascene arose and were able to defend the iconic tradition without having to fear reprisals from the iconoclastic emperors. This article details the various emperors who were against icons and their successors, their attempts, for example, at the Synod of Hyrea, which took place in 753, to create a formal condemnation of icons in the Eastern Church. It's notable that the great patriarchal sees of Antioch, Jerusalem, and Alexandria and Rome were not represented at this synod, and this was the great iconoclastic synod, which claimed that to depict Christ was a significant theological error. Nevertheless, particularly the monastic tradition remained faithful to the production of and to the safeguarding of sacred icons, and so the monasteries were subject to particularly vicious and brutal attack, and there were indeed martyrs during the period of iconoclasm, both the first and the second iconoclastic periods. You'll notice on this page several depictions from illuminated manuscripts. The first, and there's a picture of the whole page in the left-hand image, and then a close-up in the middle and the right-hand side. What you have depicted is, in the middle, you can see it clearly, an iconoclast with a pot of whitewash in front of him, taking a long pole, which is basically a brush, and whitewashing over an image of Christ. That's what he's doing. This is on a page from an illuminated manuscript of the 9th century. It's looking back at the iconoclastic controversy, and it's depicting this iconoclast on the one hand, and then on the upper right of that page is a crucifix. And it shows the soldiers brutally attacking Christ, and then next to the soldier on the right is another iconoclast with his pot of whitewash reaching up to whitewash over this image of the crucifix, which at the same time, paradoxically, is the real thing. The implication of this is very clear, that the iconoclasts are like those who persecuted the Lord. So the later icon-respecting tradition will look back on the iconoclastic emperors and patriarchs as those who basically persecuted Christ in their own day by attempting to destroy sacred images. And they would point out, for example, that although the emperor required the destruction of sacred images, he nonetheless permitted his own images to continue to be produced. The resolution of the first phase of iconoclasm was partly the result, principally the result of the accession of the Empress Irene, who was a regent for her young son. She was not a nice person. Eventually, in order to seize power, she had her son blinded so that she could become the sole regent, and he eventually died, partly as a result of the wounds that he'd received in this torture and blinding. But Irene was a defender of icons and has subsequently been effectively almost canonized. If you drop down to the third set of pictures, she's depicted on the far left, both as empress and in a sense as a kind of saint, the great defender of the icons. The second phase of iconoclasm occurred after she lost power and took place under the Emperor Leo V, the Armenian, and this occurred in about 814. It was during this period and after the Council of Nicaea, the Second Council of Nicaea had met in 787 to effectively nullify the Synod of Hyrea and to as we shall see when we look at the text of the Synod, to validate the veneration of icons and provide a theological basis for this. It was following that council that there was a second outbreak of iconoclasm, which effectively repudiated the Second Council of Nicaea. And again, it seems to have been an emperor and the army filled with a kind of theological and political conviction that the reverencing of icons was bad for the empire, that it was not approved by God. Who knows what reasons were all involved in it, but there was again a second outbreak of iconoclastic frenzy and a second wave of this image-smashing approach. And you can see in the second set of pictures, which is also a Byzantine illuminated manuscript, here you have the Emperor Leo debating the question of iconoclasm on the one hand, while you have both iconoclasts, again, with a rather elaborate bucket of whitewash reaching up to disfigure an image of Christ on the one hand, while on the other, in the close-up, you can see there are two prelates who are holding an image and who represent the iconodules, those who continue to worship and to regard the veneration of icons as appropriate. Finally, if you drop down again to the bottom set of pictures, you can see the resolution of this second phase of iconoclasm during the time of, and not only under the influence, of the accession of another empress, the widow of the Empress Theophilus, Theodora, who was also the regent for her son, and she saw to it that an iconodule, an icon respecting a monk, was made patriarch in 843, and during her reign and through the influence of Methodius, the Second Council of Nicaea was held to be ecumenical, was again regarded as definitive for the Eastern Church, and this declaration was celebrated as the Feast of Orthodoxy, the Feast of the Vindication of Icons. And in this depiction, which is both in the center and on the far right of the last set of pictures on this page, you can see the Empress Irene, the Empress Theodora, forgive me, on the standing to our left of an image of the Blessed Virgin and the Christ Child, and her little son is standing next to her. Again, on the far left, that's an image of the earlier iconodule Empress Irene. So this is a kind of a very broad summary. Please go ahead and read the text, which again is only a very brief introduction to this very complex and twisting period of intertwined political and theological concerns that resulted finally in the vindication of the veneration of icons, and at the same time had the effect of effectively destroying an entire series of generations of Christian art, with the exception of the regions where the emperor could not reach, such as the Muslim-controlled areas of Palestine and the Sinai. And also, in the West, there were examples of iconography which had been created which were not able to be defaced by the imperial authority. And so there are some very beautiful examples from this early period, as we've seen, at Ravenna and in other parts of Italy where Byzantine art was widespread.